There's something involving. Whatever may come,
I'll be right with you.
They say the next big thing is here, that the revolution's near. But to me it seems quite clear that it's all just a little bit of history repeating.
All right, welcome to it. It is a Thursday afternoon or evening, depending where you are. I am Nicole Sandler here at Radio Or Not. And wow, what a long marathon day this has been. Perhaps you are one of us who watched the president and the healthcare summit today, which just ended a little while ago. It ran really late, but that's okay. I thought it was a pretty feisty at moments. And well, we're going to start off the show right off the bat with somebody I've been looking forward to speaking with for a long, long time. Jonathan Cohn is senior editor at the New Republic. He's also the author of Sick, The Untold Story of America's Healthcare Crisis and the People Who Pay the Price. And in addition to watching the summit live, I was on Twitter and I found myself constantly retweeting Jonathan's tweets. So and I know you're on a deadline. I thank you so much for joining us tonight here on Radio Or Not.
Oh, it's my pleasure, and I'm glad to know those are useful. I'm still learning this art of, you know, deep thoughts in 140 characters or less.
As am I. It is truly an art because, you know, well, me, I talk and I ramble. So, but no, you're doing a great job. And let's just start off. I know you're on deadline and you don't have a lot of time tonight. So what did you think of today? Let me make this a two-part question. What did you think it was going to be going into it? And what are your thoughts now that it's over?
Well, I honestly didn't know what it was going to be. I've been telling people all week, everybody assumed it was this, you know, you kept hearing it's a charade, it's all scripted, and I kept saying, well, that's nice, can you show me the script? Because I don't think anybody really knew what was going to happen. And I think what we found by the time we were done, you know, there was a little partisan, you know, there was a little sniping, and got a little personal, and I think that's what you're going to see on the news. I'm sure every news broadcast is going to replay that moment between Obama and McCain.
Oh, yeah.
You know, but mostly it was arguments about how to do healthcare policy, which, you know, as a healthcare wonk, I was thrilled with. I was happy to see that argument. I thought there was a little dishonesty in places, and we can talk about that if you want. I thought most of it came from the Republicans, but, you know, at least there was a lot of arguments, and hopefully I think people came away with a sense that, you know, the reason, you know, there's a way to do this. There's a way to solve our country's healthcare problems, and but it requires doing something big. And I think that was the president's message: was you can't do baby steps here if you want to solve this problem. You have to do something big. And clearly, the Republicans don't want to do that.
No.
And it doesn't matter how many of their ideas, you know, the Democrats incorporate into their scheme. It doesn't matter how many sort of Republican twists on this they incorporate. They just don't want to do it. And you know, that's their right. But then, you know, the Democrats should just move forward on their own.
Yeah, well, agreed. And it seemed like that's what Obama said at the very end. Did you get the same message from him?
I did. You know, it was interesting. I was listening to him at the end, and he said something about a couple weeks, and I said, uh-oh, and I thought, where are we going with this? But I think the message, you know, I hear a couple of weeks, and I sort of, like, at this point, we don't need more weeks. We need to move forward. But I think his message was, look, I've taken a lot of your ideas, but there are some differences we have, and you guys need to decide if those are too big to bridge. And if they are, well, then, you know, okay, we'll move ahead. We'll pass this. You know, we have our accountability moment in November, but we think this is the right thing to do. And we think in the end, you know, that this is what the American people want, because they say they want the healthcare crisis solved. And when you tell them what's in the plan, you know, you ask them a generic poll question, and you say, do you like the healthcare plan? And you'll get negative answers. But then you take the ideas of the healthcare plan, and you say, do you want to do this? Do you want to do that? Do you want to make sure anybody can get insurance, do you, you know, et cetera. And they like it by large margins. So I think that was his message.
Yes. Yes. And in fact, he even called Mitch McConnell on that. At one point, Mitch McConnell was talking about, well, the American people don't like this plan. And he started citing poll after poll. And Obama said, well, let me just address that for a second, because when the, you poll the people on the individual aspects of the plan, they do like it. So, you know, he did, you know, the president is doing what he's good at. And I guess that was the whole setup aspect the Republicans were talking about. Well, you put him in a room without a script and he knows his stuff. And I think the scripted part came from mostly the Republicans, who their script read, we need to scrap this whole thing and start from scratch.
That's right. That's right. You kept hearing that mantra, you know, you need to start from scratch or we're not interested in talking. And again, you know, if you're, if that's their belief, and that's, I don't begrudge them that, that's their, I mean, they have a right to their opinions and they should act on those opinions. I do think, you know, I think it's remarkable. We've seen this now a number of times in the last few months. Say what you will about the president, like him, don't like him, agree with him, don't agree with him. He knows his stuff.
Mm-hmm.
He is smart. This is, you know, and I always say, just as a commentary, frankly, after, you know, I saw the second, you know, Cantor walk and he had that big stack of papers, right?
Mm-hmm.
You all knew what that was going to be. You know, this is the bill. Look how big it is. And I thought Obama had just the right answer to that, and something I've thought for a long time, which is, yes, this health care bill is long and complex, and that is because health care is complex and requires a complex solution. And I feel like we just went through two presidential terms where they made policy decisions on the back of a napkin. That didn't work out so well. I sleep better at night knowing that the guy in the Oval Office and the people around him take this stuff seriously and are grown-ups about it. And when they see a complicated problem, they sit down and say, all right, what do we need to do to fix this? What is the right thing to do? And then they look at the political situation and try to figure out what they can get through it.
I agree. Jonathan Cohn with us, author of Sick. So you've been on the healthcare trail for a long time. You're one of the I think, the best authorities out there on it. There's been a lot of disappointment among progressives, myself included, that the administration right out of the gate threw the single payer idea away and took it off the table. Then the public option, which seemed to have been resuscitated in recent days, they're sort of poo-pooing that as well. It was brought up a couple of times today, though, in a surprising way.
It did come up a few times. Speaker Pelosi brought it up
yeah.
at the end.
Mm-hmm.
I think her point was very much I read her mention of it as another demonstration of, look, don't tell us that we haven't tried to compromise. We've compromised an enormous amount. We've given up.
Yeah, we gave it away.
We gave away the things we cared about most. And I speak as someone who, you know, in my book and in my writings, I mean, I've always said, you know, I would love to have a single payer system. I think they're fantastic. It would be my first choice. I was a strong public option supporter. I remain a strong public option supporter. But, you know, I understand the realities of the United States Senate, and they're maddening, they're frustrating. But and now even the United States House, it is hard in this political environment to do that. And I think the decision that the White House made, and you know, was, and that the congressional leaders are going along with, is that they can't get that through Congress right now. It's just not there. Even with a push, even if they lobby behind it, it just will not go through. I mean, you can't be sure, but that is their opinion, and that is why they're dropping it. I thought it was telling that Jay Rockefeller joined that opinion. And for people who don't know, historically, Jay Rockefeller, there's nobody alive in U.S. Congress right now who's done more on behalf of expanding access to health care than Jay Rockefeller. And he was the early proponent of the strong public option in the Senate. He cares about it as much as anybody. And he came out a few days ago and said, look, we just can't do this right now. I think his calculation is that he wants it very badly, but he also wants very badly to get health insurance to 30 million people. He wants to make sure everybody has good coverage. He wants to get this bill. There's too much good in this bill to risk undermining it by putting on the public option that, frankly, the margins in Congress are so narrow right now that you add that to it, there's a very good chance it could just sort of, you know, weigh down the entire bill. So, you know, I'm disappointed. Obviously, I'm frustrated. I don't know that I can honestly, I don't blame them for taking it off the table, though.
Do you think that what you just said, Jay Rockefeller believes that there is enough good in this bill to pass it and then try to tweak it as time goes on and eventually bring in the public option? Or a Medicare buy-in?
I've been saying, I thought one of the best summaries of healthcare I remember this whole fight, Tom Harkin,
who was excellent today, I thought.
Yes, he was fantastic, I thought. It's funny because, he's on the health committee. He's now in charge of the health committee. But, he was sort of number three when Kennedy was there, and then it was Dodd, and then it was him. And, of course, Kennedy passed away, and Dodd took over while he was sick and then afterwards. But then Dodd left for banking. And so now he's kind of become the guy on the health committee. But he hasn't been that out of front on these issues. So it's been a very pleasant surprise to hear him because I think he's got a great way with words. And, he is from Iowa. He speaks, I think, to a lot of middle America. And he had this wonderful analogy, I thought, that I've used a million times, which is, when the Senate first passed their version of healthcare reform, he said, this is not a mansion, he said. This is a starter home.
Right.
But it's got a really good foundation, it's got a sturdy roof, and it's got tons of room for expansion. And, that's the way to look at it.
You feel good about this? I mean, I'm somebody who's caught up in this. My COBRA runs out on Sunday, the end of the month. I'm done. And, I'm a 50-year-old woman with pre-existing conditions. So basically, I'm screwed. If this goes through and it's looking like they're going to go by the way of reconciliation, do you think that this will make it so that me and others like me will be able to get, I will be able to get insurance?
Absolutely. I mean, that you are actually the target audience for this right now. The fact of the matter is, you can argue this about the bill will work, this about the bill won't work. One thing we know that will happen is, we're going to set up these insurance exchanges, these marketplaces, and anybody will be able to buy insurance through them and who can't get coverage, through a company. And it won't matter, if you have a pre-existing condition. It won't matter whether you've had coverage or haven't had coverage. The company has to sell it to you, and they can't charge you more just because you have a pre-existing condition.
Is that in there, really? Because I hadn't seen any cost controls in there. I thought they'd be able to price it whatever they want so they can effectively not give me coverage because I couldn't afford it anyway.
Well, they couldn't single you out for that coverage. I mean, there's nothing, the companies selling through the insurance exchanges can charge whatever they want. In theory,
right.
Or at least, well, they could. Now, this is going to get a little complicated, but, in the original Senate bill, let's say, they could theoretically charge what they wanted. But they would have to charge that to every customer. And, frankly, if, Aetna comes in and wants to charge, $3,000 a month, well, they couldn't just charge you $3,000 a month because you have a pre-existing condition. They'd have to charge everybody $3,000 a month. And so, if I'm another insurance company, I'm Cigna, that's a business opportunity because I'm going to charge $1,000 a month to get a bunch of customers. Now, it so happens that just when the president, gave his new compromise version of the compromise a couple of days ago, in response to these crazy rate hikes we've been seeing in California, they have added something where now the government would actually have the right to review rates beforehand and regulate them. And that would put a little more pressure on them. So, the answer is, you'd be able to get affordable insurance. And by the way, quite apart from the cost controls, inside these exchanges, there are subsidies. So basically, the government is saying you won't have to pay more than X dollars for your health insurance based on your, if you're at this income. And that goes all the way up to like $88,000 a year for a family of four. So someone in your position, someone like you, anyone who's one of these people stuck out there without employer-sponsored insurance, you're the big benefit. You're the big winners in this bill because you are the ones who are, frankly, getting really screwed right now. And you're the ones that this bill is going to do the most immediate good for.
Immediate? So we won't have to wait till 2013 for this to go into effect?
The second the word immediate escaped my lip, I thought I should qualify that.
Right.
Here's the thing. No, I mean, the exchanges don't get set up till 2013, 2014. Mm-hmm. That's crazy because of the keeping the price tag low. On the other hand, it wouldn't surprise me if the bill gets passed and we find a way to move that up. But in the meantime, they will set up these high risk pools, which, now that is not the greatest thing in the world, as you may know, but at least you would be able to at least get some kind of catastrophic coverage at a reasonable price, which, it won't do much for you to hit $10,000, $12,000 in expenses, but at that point, at least, then you'll be you know, at that point your exposure will be limited, and hopefully, we'll keep you out of bankruptcy or something. So for the immediate future, it might not get you aid. But, 2-3 years down the road, 3 years down the road, those exchanges come online hopefully sooner, and then you'll really be taken care of.
All right. Jonathan Cohn, I know you're on a deadline for the New Republic, and I so thank you for just joining us at the top of the show to give your thoughts. I hope one of these days we can do a longer, more in-depth talk and really get into the meat of it as we get closer to passing it. Thank you. Thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Oh, my pleasure, and thanks for saying all those nice things. I'd love to come back sometime.
Terrific. I appreciate it. Jonathan Cohn of the New Republic, author of the book Sick. All right. We'll talk soon. I really appreciate it. Bye-bye. Sick, the untold story of America's healthcare crisis and the people who pay the price. And I got to tell you, I mean, I've been trying to get him on, on the Air America show for a while, and we were never able to work it out. He must have seen all my retweets today because it seemed like I was just so in lockstep with him. Yes, it was a long, long day in Washington. I give President Obama all the credit in the world. I think he kicked ass. I do have a lot of sound today. You know what? If you want to call in, we do have some more guests coming up. David Dayan from Fire Dog Lake is going to join us in the next half hour. We'll hear from somebody at the Talk Radio News Service. And then John Fugelsang will be back for most of the last hour of the show. And we'll talk about all this stuff. But I've got a lot of sound. And again, the one exchange that you will probably hear the most of today is this little bit between between Barack Obama and John McCain. And, he just sounds like a whiny, doddering old man. At one point, I tweeted that he just needs to go home and take a nap. And at another point, I asked why he always sounds like he's whining, because he does. So, yeah, John McCain was going on and on about whatever, and Obama came back at him.
Let me just make this point, John, because we're not campaigning anymore. The election's over.
I'm reminded of that every day.
We can spend the remainder of the time with our respective talking points going back and forth. We were supposed to be talking about insurance. Obviously, I'm sure that Harry Reid and Chris Dodd and others who went through an exhaustive process through both the House and the Senate, with the most hearings, the most debates on the floor, the longest markup in 22 years on each and every one of these bills, would have a response for you. My concern is that if we do that, then we're essentially back on Fox News or MSNBC on the split screen just arguing back and forth.
Yeah, he got that right. And he did a great job, I thought, of calling the Republicans on their nonsense, on their filibustering, on their rambling, on their, their talking points. You know what I'm saying? I do want to play for you before I get into the guests and we don't have time. I want to play Nancy Pelosi's closing comments because, I'm not always that supportive of Nancy Pelosi, but I got to say, she's been awesome on the healthcare reform topic. She really has. And she was tough in her closing comments, and she called the Republican liars out for exactly what they were.
Mr. President, I hearken back to that meeting a year ago. At that time, Senator Grassley questioned you about the public option. And you said the public option is one way to keep the insurance companies honest and to increase competition. If you have a better way, put it on the table. Well, I bring that up because we have come such a long way. We're talking about how close we are on this, how far apart we are here. But as representative of the House of Representatives, I want you to know that we were there that day in support of a public option which would save $120 billion, keep the insurance companies honest, and increase competition. We've come a long way to agreeing to a Republican idea, the exchanges. Senator Enzi has been a leader in that. Senator Snow, along with Senator Durbin, had legislation to that effect, bipartisan, because the insurance companies opposed the public option. They couldn't take the competition. We have in our bill market-oriented, encouraging it to the private sector initiatives. I think the insurance industry, left to its own devices, has behaved shamefully.
Yep.
And we must act on behalf of the American people. We have lived on their playing field all this time. It's time for the insurance companies to exist on the playing field of the American people. I believe I have news for some of my colleagues, because we have very much more in common. Senator Coburn, you had so many positive suggestions, which I didn't hear much else of, but from you we did. And I think you'd be pleased to know that after much debate in our House, we came up with value, not volume. Others have called it quality, not quantity, in terms of utilization, overutilization. Senator McCain, when you talk about Florida, we're talking about addressing the regional disparities in terms of compensation and health care. So we have addressed many of these issues in the bill. I think it's really important to note, though, and I want the record to show, because two statements were made here that are not factual in relationship to these bills. My colleague, Mr. Leader Boehner, the law of the land is there is no public funding of abortion, and there is no public funding of abortion in these bills. And I don't want our listeners or viewers to get the wrong impression from what you said. Mr. Camp, you said that the Medicare cuts in this bill cut benefits for seniors. They do not. They do not. So I want the record to show, just in those two cases, where we may have...
She's calling the liars out on their lies, which was just awesome.
Have differences of opinion and of approach and evaluation of the value of different things. But certain things are facts about our bills that I cannot let the opposite view stand when they are stated. Yes, it's hard to do this. Misrepresentation campaign that is going on about these bills, it's a wonder anybody would support them, as Mr. Waxman said. But the fact is, as the President said, many of these provisions on their own are largely supported by the American people. So this will take courage to do. Social Security was hard. Medicare was hard. Health care reform for all Americans. Insurance reform is hard. But we will get it done. And as we leave this debate, I think that many of the differences that we have are complicated. And they're legitimate. They're differences of opinion about the role of government and the rest. But I think it's really clear on one point that the American people understand very clearly. They understand that there should be an end to discrimination on the basis of pre-existing conditions. The proposals that we have put forth end discrimination on the basis of pre-existing conditions. The Republican bill does not.
All right,
Mr. President, I thank you.
And so there's Nancy Pelosi's closing argument, her closing speech. You know, here's the thing on health care reform. And for people who've been listening to me for any amount of time, you know I've been critical. I've been there was a time when I said we'd be better off with nothing than with this Senate bill. I've vacillated. I've gone back and forth on it. And actually, right now, I'm of the mind that sort of what Jonathan Cohn just said, and I trust this guy. If anybody knows the healthcare system and the ins and outs of it, he's it. I mean, you've seen him on with Keith Olbermann many times. His book, Sick, I got when it came out. I'm sort of right where he was when we spoke at the top of the show. I want single payer. I think that's the only thing that would truly give us real quality, affordable health care for everybody. Unfortunately, you know, the way our government works or doesn't work in this country, they'd never get it through. I have problems with Obama having the administration taking it off the table before we even set the table, as I've been putting it. I have a problem with the way this process has been dragged out over the past year. I've got a lot of problems with it. However, that said, knowing what we're up against with these Republicans who don't want to work with the Democrats, who don't care one iota about the American people, they just care about getting power back, they're making it so difficult to get anything done. And we know where they stand on health care reform. They controlled the White House and both houses of Congress for six of the last 8 years before 2008 and did nothing. Nothing. So that's what they would do about health care. Nothing. Let 45,000 people a year die because they don't have health insurance. So that said, I really believe what Jonathan Cohn said, which is what Tom Harkin has been saying. And he said very eloquently tonight that you got to start somewhere. And even though Obama said we don't want to go incremental, he doesn't want to break this bill up and do it in pieces. I guess he wants to get through as much as he can. I've come full circle where I really think they have to get what they can get now, and then we work even harder. Just like the election of Barack Obama certainly didn't fix everything, didn't fix anything. His election was just the beginning of our very, very difficult job ahead of us. So, you know, if anything, they need to pass this bill with the fixes. And it sounds like some of the fixes are pretty good. Get it done. And then, you know, then our job really begins in making it better. And I do think that eventually we will be able to get the public option in. And eventually, I mean, if we can get what was the Kucinich Amendment in the House and what Bernie Sanders was pushing for in the Senate, which is state exemptions for the ERISA regulations, which would basically open the door and let states enact their own single-payer programs, we could get there. But if we're going to wait until we have it all done at once, I don't think we're ever going to get it. So, I think they're moving in the right direction. I know I'm sort of jumping around a little bit, but I want to play for you the very end of President Obama's speech, his very final closing statements, because here's basically where he said to the Republicans, look, I wanted to bring us all together to see where we found common ground. And if you're not going to work with us on common ground, well, we're going to get it done without you.
So the question that I'm going to ask myself and I ask of all of you is there enough serious effort that in a month's time or a few weeks' time or 6 weeks' time, we could actually resolve something? And if we can't, then I think we've got to go ahead and make some decisions, and then that's what elections are for. We have honest disagreements about the vision for the country, and we'll go ahead and test those out over the next several months till November. All right? But I very much appreciate everybody being here.
Uh-huh.
Thank you for being so thoughtful, and hopefully we'll all keep our constituents in mind as we move forward. Thank you, everybody.
All right. So anyway, I thought that was, and we'll play more of it perhaps as the night goes on. Like I said, we've got some guests coming on here. We mentioned Tom Harkin, and unfortunately I didn't get his speech on tape, nor did I get Dick Durbin's. But wow, Dick Durbin was awesome. So I will try to find that throughout the course of the night. If not, we got plenty of time to get there. Quick clarification for the people in the Ustream chat room. I'm for Earth said that she didn't want, she thought the exchange is not good. And again, yeah, first choice single payer, second choice public option, but third choice is the exchange. And she said, well, but they're going to still fix the prices. Well, no, they're not going to be able to, because the House just yesterday passed their bill that would take away the antitrust exemption that the for-profit extortionist health insurance industry has enjoyed. All right, so now it's going to go to the Senate. And the thing is, this passed something like 407 to, I don't have the numbers, to 19. I know my numbers are off a little bit. But it passed in overwhelming numbers, meaning most of the Republicans also voted to do away with the antitrust exemption that will make it illegal for the insurance companies to collude. That's what antitrust is. It allows the antitrust exemptions that only the health insurance industry and Major League Baseball enjoy in this country. If they go into price fixing, that would be, you know, grounds for them to be kicked out of the exchange and, you know, kicked out of the insurance industry. So it will be against the law. Now, we'll see what happens in the Senate if they can get past the filibuster. I can't imagine that senators will, or all of them, will vote against doing away with the Senate antitrust exemption. 406 to 10. Thank you, Shorty Dog. I knew it was something like that. So with those kind of numbers in the House, you know it'll pass in the Senate, too. Again, that is how, and Captain Krusty's asking, how do you stop them from talking to each other? The same exact way they do it in every other industry, with threat of, you know, imprisonment, of massive fines, of not being allowed to be in the insurance business anymore. There are certain things we are just going to have to, I hate to say this, trust, but we will also have to, stay on top of it. And believe me, there are people like Anthony Weiner, Bernie Sanders, so many, 406 to 19, that's more like it, yes. I knew there was a 19 in there somewhere. It's the first step in a long, in-depth process. All right. Calling on David Daya now, who is at the news desk at firedoglake.com. And, we'll check in with him right now. I think.
Hello.
Hey, Dave. Nicole Sandler calling from Radio or Not.
Hi, Nicole. How you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for joining us tonight. I spoke with Jonathan Cohen a little while ago here, and I'm chatting with the listeners and talking about the big healthcare summit today. First question for you, I'll ask the same thing I asked Jonathan. What did you think it was going to be beforehand? And then now that it's over, your impressions on a post-mortem kind of basis?
Well, I guess I didn't have very many expectations. I thought it was mainly a theatrical way to get Democrats sort of back with the program of actually, you know, pushing to pass a comprehensive bill. And, to the extent that it highlighted a lot of the differences, to the extent that there were enough outbursts that showed Republicans wanting to be unusually unhelpful in fixing the problem, I think it did a lot of that. But, you know, in terms of what was maybe highlighted initially to, work to find common ground and a substantive policy agreement and flowers and starbursts, I never expected that. And sure enough, I don't think we arrived at much of that tonight.
No, but do you think they made any progress? I don't think they made any progress on bipartisanship, but maybe in terms of explaining to the American people who I'm sure not everybody watched all 6 or 7 hours like we did, but just what they're trying to accomplish and showing how the Republicans are sort of just not getting with the program?
Well, I mean, what you said is really the problem. You know, you lose control of something like this as soon as it ends, and then it gets mediated and filtered through a media, which, you know, isn't exceedingly interested in providing the broad kind of coverage. I'm sure, I wrote this today, that it's going to be interesting to see them condense 6 hours of coverage into the one soundbite of Obama saying, "We're not campaigning anymore, John McCain," and
right.
Then a dramatic sting. You know, I mean, like, that's probably what we're going to hear out of this a lot. So, you know, I mean, it, even though there was, as you said, some very distinctive moments, I think the exchange between the president and John Barrasso, a senator from Wyoming, was extremely instructive in terms of the Democratic versus the Republican conception of the healthcare system. But I don't know that you're going to get that if you're the average person who did not watch this thing live.
Yeah, well, that's true. And you know, I was watching, it was interesting because I was watching on one of the pages that sort of had two Twitter feeds going. And one was the progressive feed and one was the conservative feed. And seeing the two different commentary threads running through, it was interesting. So I have an idea of what, you know, right-wing talk radio is going to be saying. And you know, I know what probably Rachel and Keith, if he's there tonight, are going to be saying as well. But I thought it was, you know, I thought it was a good showing for Obama yet again, in that he obviously knows his stuff. Can you imagine George Bush ever doing something like this, sitting in a room for 6 or 7 hours and talking about a really in-depth, difficult, complicated issue such as this healthcare legislation without, you know, off the top of his head?
Right. Well, sure. I mean, my initial joke today was that the White House advance team did a really, really good job of hiding all those teleprompters all around the room.
But it must have been written on his hand, you know?
Must have been very, very difficult to, you know, build in 7 hours worth of seemingly impromptu information in a giant screen somewhere that was someone, you know, somehow just off camera. I mean, Obama showed his breadth and depth in terms of dealing with the issue. He's obviously very well versed in all aspects of this debate. And he definitely showed himself to have a pretty good BS detector when Republicans were making certain charges that just did not come off as factually true. You know, it was almost this delayed reaction where you'd hear instantly a few people on Twitter or throughout the online world react instantly to some, you know, ridiculous comment made by a Republican. And then when they would finish 10 minutes later, Obama would come on and almost make the same comment.
Right.
So he definitely has a facility with healthcare, and that's a positive thing. You know, I mean, maybe this shows him in a good light, but ultimately it's going to be actions and not words, especially at this point, a year into the presidency. That's going to be what matters. So really, you have to ask yourself, what is next? That's the real question here. And, you know, I think that it's not entirely clear.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at the very end, Obama said that, you know, if you want to join us, then great, but we're going to move forward. And that's a positive thing. He then laid out a timetable that sounded like a month to 6 weeks.
Yeah.
To see if Republicans would, you know, join in. In a broad bipartisan agreement, that's a long time to just, you know, waste once again on this issue. And then even after that, you know, so I don't know where the pivot comes in, but you may need that much time to figure out how in the world you're going to get 50 votes for a reconciliation bill in the Senate and 217, which is what you need now, in the House. And what elements have to be in there in order to get all of those votes? It's a real Rubik's Cube right now to try to figure out how you can really just get this thing passed. And that's, I think, you know, while it's good that there's seemingly a strategy to move forward and advance the ball, the nitty-gritty of vote counts is going to be where the rubber hits the road.
Right. And now, I mean, what it actually seems like is perhaps the they may have an easier time getting to 50 in the Senate than to 217 in the House, most notably because the Stupak amendment is not in the bill. Now, I had heard that John Boehner invited Bart Stupak as a last-minute guest of the Republicans. I missed the beginning of it. I was listening on radio, but I had to take my boyfriend's dog to the vet this morning. So I did miss the beginning. Was Bart Stupak there?
No, he did not show up.
Oh.
He was invited, and I thought it was actually a brilliant little maneuver by John Boehner to try to highlight that issue. And in his comments, he did mention the abortion issue, but it didn't really go very far. Stupak, you know, didn't show up. He did not take the bait. But he's still lurking out there. And, you know, he made a statement a couple days ago where he said that the, you know, amendments on abortion language that's in the Senate bill is unacceptable. It was basically him saying, look, world, I'm still here. I still have, you know, a handful of members of the House who voted for the bill last time who agree with me, and you still probably don't have the majority of votes that you need without me, and you have to placate me. And he's so once again, we have this problem. And the real issue at this point is that it's unclear whether the abortion language can be changed through the reconciliation process. And if you're using the Senate bill as the base bill, you're kind of stuck with the amendment on that was put together by Ben Nelson, which Stupak finds unacceptable. And then the problem is finding the votes elsewhere to make up for Stupak and his band of anti-choice merry men to offset that and still find a majority. It's, as I said, a real Rubik's Cube to actually get to 217, especially because there's been one death, Jack Murtha, and
right.
two retirements, Robert Wexler, and at the end of this week, Neil Abercrombie, which, you know, takes three people who voted for the health care bill out of the House. So there are only 217 members who voted for the bill previously in the House. One of them's a Republican who said he's not voting for it again.
Yeah, what a
so
shame that
you're
is.
You're already under by one, and that's before you even start talking about Bart Stupak. So it's a very difficult path ahead, and it will be the achievement of Nancy Pelosi's career if she can find 217 votes for a bill.
Right. So maybe they do need the 4 to 6 weeks to get that done. But what I don't get is the language that was in there, the Hyde Amendment has worked just fine for all these years. Nancy Pelosi addressed it in her closing comment that I just played a little while ago, saying that, you know, there are no federal funds for abortions in this bill. You know, I would think that maybe, you know, this is a case where the party elders take Bart Stupak in behind closed doors and say, look, you want to win re-election, you want Democratic Party money, you get with the program here and you don't screw us.
Yeah, I mean, you'd think that would be helpful. I don't know that Stupak at this point, he's been there a long time up in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. I don't know whether he relies on Democratic Party money anymore. But the thing about what Pelosi said is, you know, you kind of don't know how true she truly, you know, was with that comment. In fact, George Washington's study showed that the Nelson Amendment, which is in the Senate bill, would be not quite, but almost as onerous on women as the Stupak Amendment. You would have to sign two different checks to an insurance company, and one that has the, you know, your basic coverage, and one that has your abortion coverage, and that segregation of funds would be how you would get around the Hyde Amendment. It could have the exact same chilling effect and end to the end of insurance coverage for abortion in the individual market. It could very easily do that. The study that GW did showed it would do that. And so, you know, I think in many ways Stupak is arguing this just because he wants a personal victory on this. And he's got the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops behind him. And he thinks that he can get this because he knows he has a majority in the House who agrees with him.
Which is just mind-blowing. And the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, I'm sorry, should have no say in what happens with the government of the United States of America.
There's no question about it. I agree with you.
Drives me 100%,
nuts. But that's where we are in 2010 in the House of Representatives. And I just don't see much of a way out here. The one thing I can think of is that, you know, the House would put a standalone bill on the floor that would essentially be Stupak's amendment and force the rest of the caucus to vote for it. And I just don't see that they will.
Mm-hmm.
Basically Jan Schakowsky and members of the pro-choice caucus said there's no way we're voting for health care again if it has that in there.
Right, right.
So, you know, you get it from both sides. And I don't think Republicans will be very helpful in that effort, even if they support the anti-choice language in the Stupak amendment.
Right. Well, I'll tell you, two House members. We're speaking with David Dayan, by the way, who's at the news desk at FireDogLake.com. Two progressives who voted against the health care bill are Dennis Kucinich and Eric Massa. I don't know, I don't know what it would take to get Massa on board because he's a single payer guy. But he might be persuaded to go along. And I think Kucinich, if they would get the Kucinich amendment back in there somehow, which would allow states, an ERISA waiver, basically,
right,
to enact their own single payer program, I think that would be all it would take to get Kucinich back on board. And that would open the door to state single payer programs.
Right. I don't know how they get that in reconciliation. Once again, the Senate bill is essentially what the House will pass. Then they will do a sidecar, quote unquote, that would be accomplished through reconciliation. And pretty much everything in that sidecar has to have a budgetary impact on the federal budget. Giving a waiver to states doesn't really have a federal... I mean, maybe they could design it in such a way that it does.
Yeah, because it would allow states to...
It would be unclear to me that it would. There is an amendment in the Senate bill from Ron Wyden that allows states, if they can, you know, come up with a better solution, that they can pool their money that they get from the federal government for the purposes of health care, and create their own program. It's kind of similar to Kucinich's amendment,
and there's
not
one
wide ranging.
Right, but there's also one from Bernie Sanders that's in the Senate bill, but unfortunately, it doesn't go into effect until
right,
5 years after the exchange goes into effect.
It goes into effect down the road.
Yeah.
My point on Kucinich and Massa would be that, you know, they didn't vote for the House bill. It's well known that the Senate bill
is worse.
You know, further to the right,
mm-hmm,
of the House bill, even with the changes that have been put in, you know, on this reconciliation sidecar, it's still going to end up further to the right. Doesn't
right
have a public option,
yep,
has state-based exchanges and not national exchanges. Variety of reasons, it's further to the right. I don't see Kucinich and Massa as fertile ground for people who could flip if they voted against a bill that is to the left of what they would be asking them to vote on the second time around.
Yeah.
What you're going to see is Pelosi looking at two sets of members of Congress who voted against the bill the first time. One, people who are retiring and don't have to face the voters again.
Right.
And there are three or four of them. And number two, blue dogs who she can go to and say, look, we don't have a public option now, you know. It's not as far to the left as it was before. Give us a chance.
Mm.
So those are the votes that she's going to try to achieve. But, you know, blue dogs are going to have to be, you know, they're probably feeling pretty skittish right now. They're going to have to be giving them just the same assurances, you know, the carrots instead of the sticks, the things you wanted to throw at Bart Stupak, they're going to have to offer, I think, to a bunch of blue dogs to get them on the bill.
Well, I guess that's why they get the big bucks and get the federal health insurance program that we pay for.
Right.
because they have a hard job ahead of them.
And Dick Durbin mentioned that today, saying, you know, if you guys don't like socialized medicine, or if you call this socialized medicine, then
give it up.
Cancel your federal health insurance.
I know. Durbin was absolutely awesome, and I'm bummed I didn't get that part on tape.
He was great, and Louise Slaughter was great. You know, there were some pretty good spokespeople on the Democratic side, I would say, today.
Yeah, I thought so, too. The standouts for me really were Dick Durbin. Tom Harkin, I thought, was great.
Yeah.
And John Dingell, you know, you got to give this guy so much credit. I mean, he's the guy who every Congress he introduces, I think, a single-payer bill.
That's pretty much a Medicare for All bill. Yeah.
Right. And he's been fighting.
His dad used to introduce it.
Yes,
so, you know,
I know.
50 years ago. So, yes, he holds a lot of moral authority in this debate and may be helpful in swaying a couple nervous Democrats to get the bill done. So we'll see.
Yeah, there was one sort of weird moment when Obama referred to the OBGYNs as like OB-GYNs or something.
And, I know.
And all I could say was, thank God he didn't say anything about them practicing their love with all the women across the country.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. What is it about presidents and getting tripped up on OBGYNs?
I don't know.
No.
Were there any other moments that stood out to you? I mean, Barrasso, he's the guy who did the Republican response to, it wasn't to the State of the Union, it was to the president's joint address to a joint session of Congress on health care.
That was actually a different guy. That was Charles Bruce.
Oh.
Fanny.
Oh, okay. These doctors'
reaction to the healthcare address. He's also a doctor,
right?
And he talked about being denied coverage for a pre-existing condition. That was actually kind of an interesting moment when you had a Republican doctor talking about being denied coverage. I think one of the moves that Democrats were trying to come up with here was to point out all of the points of agreement where Republicans were willing to concede that these certain things are problems, and also areas where the steps that Republicans wanted to take are already apparent in the Democratic bills. I think these were kind of tactical steps to show the public that, you know, Republicans' concerns exist and are included in the bill. And also that Republicans agree there is a problem, and that it does require fixing, above and beyond just keeping with the status quo.
Yeah. There was another Republican who wasn't familiar with before, but a guy named Roskam, who went off on a tangent mm-hmm. about an Etch-a-Sketch, and you tweeted something beautiful, and I found myself retweeting a lot of your stuff today as well, that this Etch-a-Sketch thing will get him his first appearance on Jon Stewart. Oh, yeah.
Right. I definitely think so. Roskam, I believe, served with Obama in the Illinois State Legislature. And so he was... one of the people who got a question during the president's question time at the House GOP retreat, and he got another one today, and they seem to have a bit of knowledge of one another, and you know, I think that's why he ended up getting invited today.
I see.
But
well,
yeah, the Etch-a-Sketch analogy. I mean, that was what Republicans led with right out of the bat. Why don't you start over on a blank sheet of paper, just go ahead, as if we cannot be informed by any of the knowledge of an 18-month debate and 70 years of dealing with a broken healthcare system.
Exactly, and that was their, you know, so they're the ones who were saying, oh, it's going to be scripted, it's going to be a, you know, just a show, it's going to be a setup. Well, they're the ones who came with the script, which was, let's start from scratch. And of course, Grandpa McCain, you know, he's just sounding more and more senile with each passing day and whiny. I don't get it. But was it Barrasso who said that he thought that the government health plan, they'd all be better off with just catastrophic plans?
Yes, this was a very key moment, I think, that showed you, you know, the real Democrats and Republicans when it comes to fixing the healthcare system. He talked, for some reason, he was given the responsibility of talking about coverage expansion from the Republican perspective. You know, Republicans don't believe in coverage expansion. Their bill would only add 3 million more people to the health care rolls out of, you know, the 52 million that would still be uncovered.
Unbelievable.
You know, they believe in just lowering costs, even though the bill, you know, might not even lower costs. But so he was talking about high-risk pools and all of these other little initiatives, none of which have shown much ability to work, instead of, you know, doing a major coverage expansion. And after his presentation, Obama just said, you know, would you think it would, that we would be better off if we just offered catastrophic insurance through the federal program for members of Congress? And he said yes, because then we'd have skin in the game and we'd be smarter shoppers. Because I know you, Nicole, that if you broke a leg, surely you would comparison shop around to every hospital in your area, because you want to be a smart shopper and very very prudent about you know, who you get to fix your leg.
Of course.
That's
I would.
Clearly how health insurance works, right?
Yes.
So and then he continued by saying, well, would you believe that if you only made $40,000 a year?
Mm-hmm.
Because that's the point. You know, you have to provide some minimum level of decent coverage to people, because they can't go out and buy supplemental coverage, or they can't afford the copays or the percentage of of treatment that they have to pay because their coverage has a very low actuarial value or whatever. I mean, Bourassa was talking about how prime, you know, members of parliament from Canada or sultans, you know, would come to America to get their health care coverage because it's supposedly the best in the world. It's the best if you can afford it.
Right. The best that a lot of money can buy.
If you're left behind, then we have to deal with those people and give them some subsidies and give them the ability to, you know, get basic care. And this was what Obama was saying, and it was really the key moment where you see the difference between Democratic concerns about healthcare and Republican concerns about healthcare. I think it was very important, and hopefully that will be the soundbite that gets played over and over on cable news, and not, you know, silly gamesmanship like the McCain thing.
Yeah, exactly. All right. David Dayan, thank you so much for joining us tonight. You can find David's work at news.firedogleg.com. You do a great job covering this whole healthcare debate, and obviously it's going to be going on for a while still to come. So we'll talk again soon. I appreciate you spending some time with us tonight.
Thanks for having me on the show.
All right, take care. Okay. I thought it was, you know, it was a good exercise, but we still have a long way to go. Let's see. What can I play for you? It, you know, the thing started off, again, I missed the beginning of it because I had to take, I took my boyfriend's dog to the vet. He's still out, you know, out west visiting with his son. I'll tell you, one of the honest moments at the beginning was Harry Reid. You know, according to Brent Podowski, he's an effective majority leader. I don't see it. I mean, it kills me when I get these emails from him and the masthead on the page says, give him hell, Harry. And I think, meek little wimpy Harry Reid? And then he said this.
Again, Lamar, you're entitled to your opinion, but not your own facts.
He's talking to Lamar Alexander. Well, you know what? I guess I should play Alexander's remarks first. Here's what he said.
And my request is this, is before we go further today, that the Democratic congressional leaders and you, Mr. President, renounce this idea of going back to the Congress and jamming through on a partisan vote through a little used process we call reconciliation, your version of the bill. You can say that this process has been used before, and that would be right, but it's never been used for anything like this. It's not appropriate to use to write the rules for 17% of the economy.
Well, he was totally wrong on there. So Harry Reid decided to take him apart on rewriting history. But boy, he did it with a very misguided argument. Here we go.
Again, Lamar, you're entitled to your opinion, but not your own facts. No one has said, I read what the president has online, no one has talked about reconciliation, but that's what you folks have talked about ever since that came out.
Actually, recently, in recent days, they have been talking about reconciliation. So, you know, he didn't need to go there. He didn't need to lie.
As if it's something that has never been done before. Now, we as leaders here, the speaker and I, have not talked about doing reconciliation as the only way out of all this. Of course it's not the only way out.
Yeah, no, of course it's not the only way out. But at this point, if they're going to keep locking everything, it is. And all medical bills in the last, I don't know how many years, have been done through reconciliation. You know, I heard Rachel say it last night. Yeah, give him hell, Harry. Unbelievable. All right, any minute now, we will get the call from somebody at the Talk Radio News Service. So I'm just watching the phones on that. Let me see. Oh, I'm trying to think which clip to play for you next. Well, here is, you know, there was a back and forth again at the beginning with Obama and Lamar Alexander. And again, this guy Alexander just kept making up his own facts as he went along.
It's estimated by the Congressional Budget Office that the plan we put forward would lower the costs in the individual market for the average person who's just trying to buy health insurance and they're not lucky enough to work for a big company, would lower their costs by between 14 and 20%. So, Lamar, when you mentioned earlier that you said premiums go up, that's just not the case according to the Congressional Budget Office.
Mr. President, if you're going to contradict me, I ought to have a chance to. The Congressional Budget Office report says that premiums will rise in the individual market as a result of the Senate bill.
No. This is an example of where we've got to get our facts straight.
That's my point.
Well, exactly. So let me respond to what you just said, Lamar, because it's not factually accurate. Here's what the Congressional Budget Office says. The costs for families for the same type of coverage as they're currently receiving would go down 14 to 20%. What the Congressional Budget Office says is that because now they've got a better deal, because policies are cheaper, they may choose to buy better coverage than they have right now, and that might be 10 to 13% more expensive than the bad insurance that they had previously.
Yeah, I thought Obama did a really good job of responding to all these individual lies and points brought up by the Republicans. And again, wow, unbelievable, right off the top of his head. Go figure. All right, here's the other clip I was looking for from Harry Reid in response to, once again, Lamar Alexander talking about that reconciliation has never been used like this before, never been used for health care. Here's Harry Reid.
Since 1981, reconciliation has been used 21 times. Most of it's been used by Republicans for major things, like much of the Contract for America, Medicare reform, the tax cuts for rich people in America. So reconciliation isn't something that's never been done before.
Duh. Jay Rockefeller. Why did I say John? Jay Rockefeller he was okay. I'm really disappointed in Jay Rockefeller right now, because here's a guy who's supposed to be standing up for, you know, he's been one of the biggest advocates for the public option throughout this whole process, and now when it looks like it's possible to bring it back, he's not there. But here's a little clip of Jay Rockefeller from today.
The health insurance industry is the shark that swims just below the water. And you don't see that shark until you feel the teeth of that shark.
Okay, that's one way of looking at it. I consider the health insurance industry just extortionist, government-sanctioned extortionist. And I've said that over and over again. Chuck Schumer is one of the now 24 senators who signed on to that Bennett letter. And, yes, there are now 24 of them. And he was addressing the question of Medicare waste, fraud, and abuse.
If we're going to eliminate the waste, fraud, and abuse in Medicare, it does mean we're going to cut some of that out. And when I hear my friend Dave Camp say, you cannot cut money out of Medicare, well, we don't want to cut the good stuff that you point out or not, or prevent add the prevention. But if we're going to, if one-third, if what Senator Coburn says, that one-third of Medicare doesn't go to patient care, you can't just get up there and say, we don't want to cut anything out of Medicare. We want to cut the bad stuff and keep the good stuff. And I think that's where we can find common ground.
So, yeah, a lot of interesting stuff going on today. There are some clips I really want to play in a little while. I'll also, you know, you notice that Anthony Weiner was not invited to this get-together today, obviously, because they don't want to talk, you know, single payer. They don't want to talk public option. In fact, I just got an email from Adam Green at the Progressive Change Campaign Committee. Again, they're the ones who have been whipping this, the Bennett letter, trying to get more, more signatures. And they sent out an email a little earlier, breaking. It was a story from openleft.com. Pelosi makes strong case for House public option going forward. We must act. I didn't have a chance to read that whole thing, but here's their update. It says, Obama pretty much admits that he abandoned the public option, not because of a lack of votes, but because the White House couldn't stomach Republican government takeover talking points being used against them. And they really, really wanted Republican support. This is actually huge news. And here's the quote, an Obama quote. There were criticisms about the public option. That's when supposedly there was going to be a government takeover of health care. And even after the public option wasn't available, we still hear the same rhetoric. We have the concept of an exchange, which previously has been an idea that was embraced by Republicans before I embraced it. Now, suddenly, it became less of a good idea. So I guess the PCCC is saying that the reason the public option is off the table is because Obama couldn't stomach the criticism. I don't know that that's the case. Who knows? I mean, if you heard the interview I did last night with Miles Mogadescu, I think was his name, he cited a couple of New York Times articles that said that there was a backroom deal cut with the hospitals, the for-profit hospital lobby, that, you know, that... that precluded the public option, in which Obama supposedly said that there would be no public option in the final plan. I'm still trying to get to the root of that. I sent an email to Ryan Grimm at Huffington Post, who's done a great job covering healthcare as well. And he's the one who broke the story about the White House deal with Big Pharma. So, you know, we'll see. I haven't heard back from him, but obviously today was kind of a busy day for everybody. I'm a little surprised we haven't heard yet from anybody at Talk Radio News. Let's see. You did hear him say that. Yes, I know. Okay. I want to play you more clips from today. Let me see what else I have here and ready to go that I can just play for you. We talked, we did... Obama correcting Lamar Alexander, Obama to McCain. Is this? I wonder if this is a different Obama-McCain clip. Let's just hear it.
So, let me just make this point, John, because we're not campaigning
anymore. Oh, I already played
the elections.
And again, that's the one that's going to be played over and over and over again. Here's another clip. This was Obama in part of his early on. I don't think it was the opening comments, but it was early on during the his talking. It was while I was still in the car with Callie, with my boyfriend's dog, and he made an interesting analogy to the type of insurance he was able to purchase, that some people are able to purchase, and he made the analogy to when he was a young kid riding around in a clunker of a car, and he needed auto insurance.
You know, when I was young, just got out of college, I had to buy auto insurance. I had a beat-up old car. And I won't name the name of the insurance company, but there was a company, let's call it Acme Insurance, in Illinois. And I was paying my premiums every month. After about 6 months, I got rear-ended, and I called up Acme and said, you know,
I just got to say, did you hear that? I wonder who that was, because, you know, they were all on mic. I wish I knew who the big sigh was, but I don't think we'll find out.
To see if I can get my car repaired, and they laughed at me over the phone, because really, this was set up not to actually provide insurance. What it was set up was to meet the legal requirements, but it really wasn't serious insurance. Now, it's one thing if you got an old beat-up car that you can't get fixed. It's another thing if your kid is sick or you've got breast cancer. So the general idea has been here that we should set up some minimum standards within the exchange, that a plan that
there's the
people
sigh
are
again.
Buying into, whether it's a small business or an individual, should be at least solid enough that if your kid got sick, they're actually going to be treated. That if something happened, that you weren't left with a huge bunch of out-of-pocket costs.
So there's Obama talking about, you know, the kind of, you know, insurance that is just there because you need something, because otherwise, you know, this is the reason why I talk about the health insurance industry is government-sanctioned extortionists. And it goes to the point that Obama just made, seriously, which is that you need to have coverage or you can't get you have to have continual coverage. You've heard that term, right? Now, I can still get coverage. My COBRA runs out February 28th. All right. But because of the HIPAA laws, now we all hear about the HIPAA laws in terms of privacy. Every time you go to the doctor, you've got to sign a slew of papers saying that, you know, who can get your information and that you got this paperwork. And that's what we know about the HIPAA laws, right? But there's another part of the HIPAA law that says you have the insurance industry, the insurance company that you're with now has to continue to give you coverage if you meet these six questions, this criteria. I wish I had it in front of me and I don't. But one of those is you've had to have had continual coverage without being more than 63 days without continual coverage. And then, you know, you have to have exhausted your COBRA. You can't have any access to any other insurance through a family member or whatever. There's those six things, but it's that continual coverage without more than a 63-day break where I think the extortion comes in. So you can get some kind of catastrophic plan with a very high deductible that these days still costs you a fortune, especially if you have a pre-existing condition, that is not going to do you any good. You're basically, I mean, through the HIPAA thing, here's how it works with UnitedHealthcare if I decide to do this. They have to offer me coverage because, again, I meet all six criteria. But because of my pre-existing conditions, here's what they will offer me. It is their most expensive policy, plus 10% times 2. So I'm throwing out numbers here, but I think it was like $400 a month. It was actually a little over $400 a month for this plan, plus 10%. So that makes it $440 a month times 2, which makes it $880 a month. So $880 a month with a $5,000 deductible. So basically, and this is just for me alone. My daughter is actually on the state health insurance, the SCHIP plan that Obama signed in to law. So this is just for me alone. Allison's already covered through the SCHIP program. So $880 a month. So what's $880 times 12? You know, figure, I'm just going to round it off and say $10,000 plus a $5,000 deductible. So basically, you know, I pay $15,000 out of pocket before they kick in a dime. What good is it? It is extortion, because I can't go, or you can't go, you know, for more than 63 days without paying these extortionists, or then they don't have to give you a policy at all. So, you know, we're screwed one way or another. And that's why I have come full circle. Now, if what Jonathan Cohen said at the top of the show is true, see, I had been under the impression that with this Senate plan, yes, they do away with the pre-existing condition exclusion, so they have to cover you, but I thought there was no control on what they can charge you, that they could say, no, all right, you have a pre-existing condition, yeah, we'll write you a policy, but we're going to charge you five times what we're going to charge the other guy who doesn't have the pre-existing condition. According to Jonathan Cohen, that's not true. They can't charge me more because of a pre-existing condition. I'm still, you know, I'm still not sure that that's right, but hey, Jonathan Cohen's the authority here, not me. So I don't know. I don't know. You know what I'd really like to do is play you, you know, I want to play the John Dingell piece. It goes on kind of long, but I think John Dingell is, you know, I got to respond, because Benedict at Large is in the Ustream chat room, and he said, go naked, Nicole. Trust me, it's exciting. 20 years without a doctor, and I'm still kicking. Yeah, but the problem is, and one of my pre-existing conditions, first of all, you know, I can deal with the thyroid thing, because honestly, I'm going to go find a doctor who's not covered on the insurance plan anyway, because the endocrinologist I need to go to who prescribes the natural thyroid, there's a couple of them in this area, and they don't take any insurance anyway. But I've just had two skin cancers. I had this squamous cell carcinoma on my nose, and I had a malignant melanoma about 2 years ago. So that's something you don't want to screw around with. I think Joy's asking me where I'm finding the audio. Two places. One is I rolled tape for a lot of the thing. I was recording it right off the internet. But also, you know, Christy Harvey joins me on the show now, hopefully every Wednesday. And her website is miccheckradio.org. Miccheck, MICCHECK radio.org. And they've got a lot of the shorter clips that I'm playing came from Christy. The longer ones are ones that I pulled. But yeah, you can find a lot of that up there. MicCheckRadio.org. You know what? Let's just do this. How about we just call John Fugelsang? Because I'm ready to bring him into this conversation. For those of you just joining us, let me see if I not have his number already plugged in here? How silly of me. Bear with me a moment while I pull up John Fugelsang's number, and we will get him on the line. Actually, I'm a couple of minutes early, so, you know, but we'll call him anyway. And, I don't know if John watched the healthcare stuff today or not, but we will find out shortly. Doesn't it sound like I'm calling Europe? By the
Hello.
Way, John Fugelsang.
Nicole Sandler.
How are you?
I'm great. Are we on break? Are we live?
We are live.
Well, hello, everyone in Nicole land.
You know, it's the new era of the Nicole Sandler show, where I don't have a call screener or a board operator to make the phone calls for me. So we're just informal. We do it live on the. I can't even say on the air. I don't. I got to come up with like new vernacular
live.
Here.
Well, this is a very special landline I have here in Manhattan. It's reserved just for you and my meth delivery guy, so I'm glad to hear your voice.
Well, I'm glad to hear yours. Now, you've been kind of sick in recent. I mean, before I left for California, you didn't do the show because you were sort of, you know, you were not feeling well.
That's true. I spent a lot of time in North Florida. That's my particular kind of masochism, Nicole, and my parents have been in some health difficulties, so I've been spending a lot of time down flying from New York or L.A., wherever I'm living, down to see them. And in the course of this, I invited a friend of mine to come with me, and she brought her baby, and I came back with a cold because I held a snot machine on a plane.
Uh-huh.
And then it turned into the flu, and then it turned into a sinus infection on top of the flu. So I've been pretty much living in leper quarters lately, so it's actually really good to be able to speak to you again and not sound like 80s Bob Dylan.
Yeah, well, and also you're now you've got some lovely weather to deal with in New York too, don't you?
New York's a slush factory. It's insane. It's just actual physical slush is falling from the skies today in buckets.
Yeah.
It's not even hitting the ground and becoming slush. They skip the processing and it's organic slush from the skies.
Lovely. Well, you're not going out in it anyway, are you?
I've been out in it all day, and it's pretty cinematic, but it's really easy to get wet. It's disgusting, and they predict up to 10 inches of snow by tomorrow. It's so much slush that the slush is sticking and allowing snow to form on top of it, so it's pretty dramatic weather in New York, but you wouldn't know anything about that in Miami, would you?
No, but let me tell you, it has been freezing here all day. I don't think, and I know it's all relative, but I don't think it got out of the 50s today in Florida. And I'm in Miami, so we're talking South Florida. It is warmer. I was in Los Angeles and out on the West Coast, where it does get cooler in the winter. It was warmer there than it is here, and it's supposed to get freezing again tonight.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So, no, there's no global climate change.
Well, and that's the thing. You know, you're going to – one of the environmentalists tend to blow it, like a lot of liberals do. Liberals are more evolved, but they're not as good at staying on a consistent message. And, you know, for so long, the environmentalist movement has been about save the planet, save the planet. The planet's going to be fine. It's save the humans. The focus has to change from saving the whales to saving the Homo sapiens. And one of the things that the community is erred on is the phrase global warming rather than global climate change, because warming implies it's going to get hot, which it is. And despite the fact that none of us know any scientists who are buying beachfront property right now, the right-wing meme remains, if it's this hot, Al Gore should give his Oscar back. And the media perpetuates this.
Yeah. Yeah, no, you're right. And who was it who tweeted, it'll stop snowing when Al Gore cries uncle or something, because it's snowing, there's no global warming. Well, duh, maybe the reason it's snowing so much is because the planet is heating up and more moisture is being, evaporated and then comes back down in the form of precipitation.
Exactly right. I'd love to be able to say that this entire climate change phenomenon is a secret plot by all of the world scientists of every language in a sinister liberal attempt to reduce pollution. But even if I mean, we should only be so lucky. This is the great fundamental irony of this is that the people right now who are opposed to believing in climate change won't be around to pay the price for having doubted it.
No, of course not. They'll be long gone. And, well, as we know from these people, they don't care about the future generation. It's just like, they call themselves pro-life, yet they're pro, life in the womb. They don't care about the kid once it's born.
That's why we're a great country, Nicole, because only in America can you be pro-death penalty, pro-war, pro-unmanned drone bombs, pro-landmines, and still call yourself pro-life.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible. John Fugelsang is with us, who now, by the way, has a website at johnfugelsang.com, but you need to figure out how to spell it.
Yeah, good luck on that.
You should do like Tom Hartman. Tom Hartman has gotten the URL for every possible spelling of his name. So even if you spell it wrong, it still brings you to tomhartman.com.
Well, the problem is I couldn't afford all the URLs for the different ways to misspell my name. I've been called Fugle Bugle, Bugle Sang, Flugelhorn, Frusenglage, Farfik Dugan, Fungal Sang. Pretty much anything beginning with F-U applies to me.
Oh. Well, speaking of F-U, did you watch any of the healthcare summit today?
It's pretty remarkable, yeah. I mean, we're turning into the British Parliament. You're really getting to see your government working. It's great theater. And it's great entertainment. What was your take on it?
I was really impressed. I was a little worried because the last one, the first one that Obama did with the Republican House caucus, I thought was brilliant. It was so good. Then when he did the next one where with the Democrats, it was very scripted. It was just dreadful. This, though, I thought showed Obama as the brilliant man that I know he is. I mean, I'm still not thrilled with how he's handled this whole health care monstrosity. And I'm not thrilled with where we are now and what the bill will have in it. But he showed his command of the topic. He showed that, you know, he knows more than any of those Republicans in the room, or maybe all of them put together. And I thought it was really good. I just wish, you know, more than people like us had watched it.
Well, I have to disagree with you there, because what he's doing and the genius of this is that he's taking C-SPAN primetime.
Yeah.
He's showing parliamentary procedure. Now, a lot of us, I assume you have all the cool nerds in your audience who've had the experience of watching British Parliament, watching, you know, either on the BBC or on C-SPAN when they show it at 2 o'clock in the morning. And it's fascinating to watch. And I used to watch and just think, my God, Bush wouldn't last 30 seconds with a crowd like this.
Well, yeah, and I said that today too, which is, you know, can you imagine Bush in a room like with a meeting like this for an hour, let alone 7 hours?
Well, they wouldn't televise it, you know, that's for sure.
Oh, no.
And the same with Bush's father. I think that, you know, Clinton is a guy who could have handled himself really well in the situation. I think Lyndon Johnson would. I think Nixon would have. And that's really it. So it's a great chance for your president to get to flex their intellectual muscles and, you know, show off their telegenic skills. But more than that, we're watching Obama begin a reelection campaign. Rahm Emanuel reads polls. That's his job, and they know how dire the situation is. I think that this is the week that it began to really look like Obama is really pretty confident about his reelection prospects. Despite the polls, when you look at the announcement about having all the troops back from Iraq by then, about bringing back 30,000 from Pakistan by then, and when you look at the CPAC polling for president, the Obama White House is feeling pretty snug right now.
Yeah, except, and here's the conversation. I had Jonathan Cohn on at the beginning of the show and Dave Dayan from Fire Dog Lake just a little while ago. The challenge that he's got now is, you know, I think it's going to be a no-brainer, no problem getting the 51 votes in the Senate. I think the real fight is going to be getting to 217 in the House because the stupid or STUPAC amendment is not in there. And they lost Robert Wexler, and they lost, I'm losing, who died?
Who died? John Murtha.
John Murtha. And Abercrombie from Hawaii is retiring, I think, after tomorrow. So they're down 3 votes there. And it's going to be tough getting the votes in the House.
Well, I actually have to paint a bit of a bleaker picture than that, because I don't think they can get 51 votes for a public option.
No, well,
Harry Reid's been crowing.
Well, the public option is gone. I mean, even with this letter. But, you know, I had a guy on yesterday who wrote a thing on Huffington Post, and he cited 2 stories in the New York Times about some supposed backroom deal that the White House made with the hospital lobby, the for-profit hospital lobby, that basically said there will be no public option in the final bill. I think they can get to 50 in the Senate, but I think the White House doesn't want it, and I believe that they made a deal that there would not be a public option.
Well, and that's ironic, because they made a deal with Big Pharma to allow for a public option. So I want to know, if the public option doesn't pass, is the deal with Big Pharma off, or is just Big Pharma has agreed to support whatever it is Obama puts forward?
I didn't see that a public option was in that Big Pharma deal. Well, the way I read about that deal was that Big Pharma agreed that to give back, and I don't have the numbers in front of me, but so much money over 10 years, which is a drop in the bucket to them because of how much money they make, and to spend so much money in favor of in advertising support for the Democrats' plan, whether there was a public option in it or not.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, and it's kind of sad to see the phenomenon of a president whose Twitter page is fighting harder for a public option than he is.
Yeah.
And again, you know, he did campaign on this, and the damnable thing about it is that we're not hearing the voices in the media. We're not hearing the outcry for the public option, except on MSNBC. I mean, the polls reflect that people would want this or even want a Medicare-type system. Now, if you did these polls on CNN and said, would you favor a Medicare for All program, you'd see overwhelming support for it, and it still wouldn't make a difference to the Democrats. You know, this is the problem that we face at this point in the empire's history. We are Rome with bad lumming, and there's just too many senators bought and paid for by the insurance companies, as Anthony Weiner bravely pointed out this week. But it goes both ways, and the Democrats are just as guilty. Harry Reid's job essentially is a vote hunter, and that's all he's really proven good at is counting votes. He's certainly not good at building coalitions or getting a movement forward. I've been much more impressed with Pelosi during this entire process. Now, Obama could sit down and in a one-page executive order authorize expanding Medicare coverage to anybody who applies for it. He could do it in less than a page and make it law tomorrow, the same way Harry Truman desegregated the military.
Are you you're sure about that?
Yes, he is, and Tom Hartman's actually talked about this as well. He could sign an executive order expanding Medicare coverage.
Wow.
He could do it. Now, even if Harry Reid had 51 votes to support a public option tomorrow, he'd still have to get 60-vote filibuster-proof majorities to force a vote on a vote, things like that. So as much as you're hearing a lot of press from the Democrats, what you're really hearing is the progressive Democrats trying to rally the base. They're not going to pass the public option with 51 votes.
Yeah, well, no, I think what they get through reconciliation will be this sort of fix on the Senate bill so that they can get enough votes in the House to get it through. But I think that the sticking point is going to be STUPAC. And what David Dayen said just a little while ago is without the public option, they may be able to go back to some of the blue dogs who voted against the House bill in the first go round because it had the public option in it and say, look, mm-hmm. Okay, now you don't have the public option. We still have the Hyde Amendment language, not the STUPAC amendment, but the Hyde Amendment takes care of the fact that no federal funds go to fund abortion. There's no public option.
1976.
So, yeah, exactly. And but now that there's no public option, because you remember the House bill that passed with just a two vote, you know, margin, did have the public option in it. So now that there isn't a public option, they may be able to muster those votes together, but it's still going to be really tight. I mean, the fight is in the Democratic caucus.
It will be, but you know, I got to say, it's a failure for Democrats for not being able to get their message across. They have failed, and Obama has failed at getting the message. And I think if you still had Howard Dean in charge of the DNC, you wouldn't have had these difficulties at all. Dr. Dean could have been Obama's greatest weapon in getting comprehensive, real reform.
I agree with you. But
it can't be called reform.
No, I agree with you. But, I think it was the one time I had Howard Dean on the show, I asked him. I mean, obviously there's bad blood between he and Rahm. And when Obama picked Rahm Emanuel, a lot of people were screaming. And though I wasn't thrilled with the choice, I thought, you know what? Good. He needs a hatchet man who's going to get things done. Unfortunately, what I didn't realize was that Rahm is just a DLCer, that he's no better than a blue dog. And he did not, he's the one who pulled any progressive tendencies out of Obama and turned him into a conservadem.
Well, we're just seeing Bill Clinton's first term all over again, except for a slightly better marriage. It's pretty much been the same exact plot, right down to the 1 year mark and the low poll numbers. I think that we're seeing exactly what we saw in the Clinton administration, except Clinton ran a bit more to the left than Obama did. But you're going to see Obama adopting more and more conservative viewpoints. The conservatives will not like him more for this. They resent him more. And the liberals will like him more for it. Bill Clinton did this and went to the right. It saved his presidency. The liberals loved him for being popular, but the conservatives hated him even though he was adopting so much of their agenda. And that was really when I first learned that it's not about ideology. It's about who's got the ball.
Yeah.
And we're going to see that happen here. The more to the right Obama goes, the more it will increase his popularity with the left.
You think so?
Because that's how he wins.
Wow.
Yeah, I do. How he wins. Mm. I don't think Rahm is going to be invited back for a second term. But when you look at how in disarray the potential Republican field is, I don't know if you had the pleasure of enjoying as much of CPAC as I did. CPAC is sort of like Tupac, except they're the white thugs. do you think that Ron Paul is going to be able to carry 70% of the vote in the Republican primaries?
No, and you know what? And I didn't see any of CPAC because I was out having a music week. Oh, John, we need to talk music. But we'll get there in a second, and I'll tell you some of these bands that I saw. But tell me about CPAC. I know that the fact that Ron Paul won the straw poll at CPAC for who should be their nominee for president in 2012 just shows how in total disarray the Tea Partiers and the Republican Party are.
Mm-hmm. Well, it also shows how many of the Tea Partiers were at CPAC. You know, Ron Paul, look, I set off for a long time. Last year, if the American people really wanted change, they would have picked Dennis Kucinich and Ron Paul.
Yep.
They didn't. They picked a moderate and a moderate. And we all saw how, you know, exciting that's been. But the fact that Ron Paul did so well has been hilarious to me to see how enraged it's made some of the members of the RNC. Last year at CPAC, at this very same time, the winner with 20% of the vote was Mitt Romney.
Mm-hmm.
He came in first with 20%. You got to think about what that means, Nicole. That means that 4 out of 5 people didn't want him, and he was the most popular guy.
Right.
This year, Mitt came in a distant second. Sarah Palin came in where she came in last year, tied for fourth. We've got to hope that's encouraging to her because Sarah Palin running may be Obama's best shot at re-election. But Tim Pawlenty, a bit absurd. You know, Tim Pawlenty is now running far to the right, and he doesn't have the black spot of coal where his heart should be that Cheney has to get through that. And Bobby Jindal wasn't even on the ballot this year. So
well,
clearly
in disarray. Bobby Jindal, his whole career died when he did the response to the first address by Obama. It wasn't a State of the Union, but his first address to a joint session of Congress. And that's how easily someone's career can fall apart. So John Fugel,
boy governor.
Yes, John Fugelsang is with us here on Radio or Not, talking about someone's career falling apart. You know, we were hearing for a couple of weeks now that a bombshell story was going to drop in the New York Times about New York Governor David Patterson. Did you hear what eventually finally came out?
Yeah, I mean, you know, New York is just as much of a gossip town as anybody else, and really the rap on Patterson in the tabloid press has been that he has a girlfriend on the side.
Right, and that's what I thought it was going to be.
Yeah, I mean, when David Patterson first took office after Governor Spitzer was taken out using the Patriot Act, folks, don't ever forget to use the Patriot Act to get rid of Elliot Spitzer, the greatest Wall Street reformer our country had. When Patterson took office, the first thing he did, he and his wife, day one, said they had both had marital problems in the past. They came right out front about it. But the big news has been that he was seen in a restaurant with a girl, and people are talking about this. And then all of a sudden, out of the blue, it's something not quite so benign as a girlfriend.
No.
And we've learned that the governor has got serious problems with his staff and you know, now he's going to be called upon to choose sides, and it's going to be pretty ugly. I mean, he announced he was running for re-election last week in upstate New York, and only 200 people showed up.
Ooh.
And really no major press. Obama has sent members of the Congressional Black Caucus as emissaries to him to ask him not to run, and he's running against his own party with record low polling numbers. So it's really going to be an ugly year in New York, but it seems like Andrew Cuomo won't have too much trouble getting the nomination.
No, and now I think he finally today said he's not going to run, now that the story broke that a domestic abuse complaint against one of his top aides, and not only is it like his top aide, I think it was like his best friend. And and there's a domestic violence involving this guy's former girlfriend, and supposedly Patterson stepped in to get the charges like dropped, or it just bad, worse than any kind of sexual thing. And I think Patterson is now gone.
Yeah, he's pretty through, and that's going to be a good thing. I do think that he's a good man. And I do think that he's a career politician. I just, it's a bad time for governors all around the country, and it's certainly been a bad time for him. But I do hope that leaving office will be the beginning of the best period of his life. his top cabinet member resigned yesterday in the wake of this state trooper scandal. And, you know, it's only going to get uglier in New York. But Andrew Cuomo is a capable man who ran HUD under Clinton. And I've met him, and, you know, he'd be a great governor for New York. And a lot of people here are very excited about him going for the job.
Well, his father was a great governor. You know, when I was just a young radio person right out of college, I moved to New York, and I was a producer at WMCA. And one of my favorite things there was I produced a monthly call-in show with Governor Mario Cuomo. It was a statewide Ask the Governor. And I got to tell you how much I loved Mario Cuomo. I almost went to work for him. And I would have, except he wanted me to go up to Albany, and I wouldn't. I said, no, let me work in the New York City office. And I don't know if it was an official job offer, but I didn't want to move to Albany. But, you know, his main aide, who used to come in and would sit in the studio, in the control room with me, screening phone calls, was none other than Tim Russert. And, and you know, the other people were there, and I don't remember anybody else, but I certainly remember Tim Russert, who I adored, and Mario Cuomo, who every time he came in, would notice if I got my hair cut or if I gained or lost some weight. I mean, he was always
a nice Catholic boy.
But you know, during that same time period, I must have met Ed Koch, who was then the mayor of New York, easily half a dozen times. And each time he'd come into the station, "Hi, I'm Ed Koch." It's like, yeah, we've met. And Mario Cuomo would go, "You cut your hair." You know, he was awesome. So,
That's why Koch lost to Cuomo in a primary.
Yep.
I actually got to meet the governor when I worked at CNBC, and I met his son when I was at NPR. And, you know, he's someone that progressives can be proud of, Democrats can be proud of. And I think he'd make a fine governor. But I got to tell you the honest truth. I think Elliot Spitzer will rise to state office again before his career is done.
I hope so. You know what? I've been critical of Elliot Spitzer, not for his sexual escapades, although I've been slightly critical of him for that. I think it's a guy thing. I think, you know, I don't know what it's like to be a man and have two heads. Unfortunately, most men think with the small one instead of the, you know, the one with the brain in it. But, you know, I don't know how that all works. But I had a problem with Elliot. Go ahead. You tell me.
Oh, well, you know, there's something that someone would call a biological imperative that God placed in the man, and it's torturous. Gore Vidal talked about how he slept with 20,000 men in his life, and that the greatest thing about turning 70 was being freed from the tyranny of the male libido.
Oh, yeah.
The greatest sin about Governor Spitzer isn't what he did. It's that he took a $1,000 an hour call girl and made her take Amtrak to D.C. when it's only a 45-minute shuttle flight. That's someone who I don't trust my state economy when he does that kind of fuzzy math.
All right, I understand that. Now, I had a problem with Elliot Spitzer because I worked in music radio for many years. And, you know, he went after the music industry, and there were some problems there, but he really went on a witch hunt for, you know, a 20th century payola thing that, you know, I think he just wanted to raise his national profile. And he hurt a good friend of mine who was not doing anything illegal. She was fully above board, and he targeted her. So I sort of had a thing for him. But you know what? The more I know of Elliot Spitzer post, you know, sex problems, the more I like him. And I would love to see him in office more than the majority of people who are in elected office these days.
Well, exactly right. I mean, I met him when he was the attorney general for the state of New York. It was when I first met him when I was at CNBC. And one of the most intense, charismatic, and you know, morally driven man I ever met. You know, his personal marital problems aside, he's got a strong marriage, and I'm glad that they've made it last. And, you know, he, like many progressives, comes from a place of morality. You know, the problem we have in this country is that the conventional wisdom is that the right wing has the morality because they accept Jesus, because they are the Christians. When in reality, they worship Jesus as a god, because that's a lot easier than following his teachings. The time is well past for liberals to stand up the way Bobby Kennedy did and say, "I am progressive because I'm Christian, because I believe in Christ." Now, I don't know if that'll ever happen or not, but I've said it on your show before. We have to remind the conservative movement that Jesus was a peaceful, radical, nonviolent revolutionary who hung around with lepers, hookers, and crooks, wasn't American, never spoke English, anti-capitalist, anti-death penalty, anti-public prayer, never anti-gay, didn't mention abortion, and was a long-haired, brown-skinned, homeless Middle Eastern Jew. Jesus was liberal. That is the progressive point of view, and it's the moral point of view. And we have got to stand up against these Republicans and fight them on their own terms and use their own book against them.
You're absolutely right. It's somewhere in my online travels today, I came across a picture of a sort of what was probably an accurate rendering of what Jesus looked like. And he was certainly a black man. Not at all the, you know, the Anglo, you know, Jesus Christ superstar image that we've been fed for so long.
No, Jesus Bon Jovi. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's pretty funny. St. Paul is the one who really describes Jesus physically and talks about, you know, his skin and his hair being as wire. And this is a Middle Eastern guy. You know, that's not too remarkable. Every color makes Santa Claus look their own way, too. And I don't look down on people who grew up finding peace in a Caucasian Jesus. But the reality is much more interesting than the myth. And if you believe in Jesus as the Bible describes him, then you're the ultimate irony. Because the only way to be a conservative Christian is to be a radical liberal, because that's what Christ was.
You're absolutely right. And you know, so it galls me when people use their, you know, their impression of what religion is, of what Jesus was, of what Christianity is, and use it for their own purposes. And, you know, let's go to one of our favorite topics again, is Sarah Palin. And I told a story last night that I'm really surprised hasn't gained more traction. And I don't know if you've heard this or not. Andrew Sullivan, who, you know, writes for The Atlantic, wrote about this a few weeks ago, about, you know, Sarah Palin's youngest child's name, Trigg?
Yeah.
Okay.
Trigg.
Trigg. Do you know the medical term for Down syndrome?
No, I don't. I thought it was Down syndrome.
No, the actual medical term is trisomy 21 or trisomy G. It is often shortened in medical slang to tri-G, T-R-I-G.
So?
Her son's name is Trigg.
Right.
T-R-I-G. The medical term for Down syndrome is tri-G.
Okay, we're gonna have to disagree on this one, Nicole. Because the most likable thing about Sarah Palin is that finally a white person gets to name their kids wacky names they just pulled out of their ass, and I like that about her. All of her kids have wacky names, and I think you're giving her a little too much academic credit
but she
would even know what a medical terminology for
Down
syndrome.
But apparently in her book, according to Andrew Sullivan, in her book, she attributes the name coming from some Norse. I'm going to pull up the whole thing and read you exactly what he said. I get that she gets that she saw the name of this condition and took this from that more than okay. I'm quoting from Andrew Sullivan's The Daily Dish, okay? While I'm at it, does anyone actually believe that Palin's name for the child of miraculous provenance was found by her deep knowledge of ancient Norse, as she claims in her magical realism novel, Going Rogue? And he writes, I mean, seriously, she knows about as much ancient Norse as she does English grammar. So I wouldn't doubt that she saw when she knew that she was carrying a child with Down syndrome that the medical term is tri-G. And she said, oh, Trigg, you know, Bristol got her name because Sarah Palin wanted to work at ESPN, which was based in Bristol, Connecticut.
Well, you know, maybe you're right. But it's not an aspersion I'd be willing to cast until I had some more evidence about it. Sarah Palin is a very white person married to an extremely white man. He wants to leave America, and she wants to continue Bushnomics, so she's a recessionist married to a secessionist. And I wouldn't be surprised if they have corny baby name books all around the house or Viking lore. you know, I think the real scandal about Sarah Palin this week was about her grandson, Tripp, more than her son, Tig. But I do appreciate Andrew Sullivan. I always love a guy who is gay and can't bring himself to quit the Catholic Church or the Republican Party.
That's true. That is true. Now, so what is the thing about Tripp?
Well, this week, the real news for Palin, as far as I'm concerned with Tripp, was that in the custody battle going on in the POG court system, Levi Johnston, Huffington Post's favorite Wicked Male model, entered a brief that stated that he wouldn't have to pay child support for Tripp's health care because Tripp's health care is already covered
under
a state plan through the reservation. What we found out this week was that Sarah Palin's grandchild is on government-funded health care. The same government-funded health care she's been warning us about is the socialism that's been taking care of her own grandchild, and I want to know why she hasn't been protecting Tripp from the death battles.
And that's a very good question, because, you know, God knows it's only a matter of time.
Mm-hmm. And, again, this is the week with Dick Cheney, opposed to socialized health care, and life saved by socialized health care, and weep for it.
Wait, say that again. I'm sorry. Our connection is getting worse for some reason.
Oh, sure. This is the week that Dick Cheney, who is opposed to government-funded health care,
uh-huh,
had his life saved by government-funded health care.
Oh, absolutely.
And we got to pay for it.
Yes. And, you know, this was his, I believe, fifth heart attack.
Yes,
this was
his fifth heart attack. But it can't be stopped. Cheney's Chucky.
It is quite amazing that you know, he takes a licking and keeps on ticking, and it's all at our expense.
Well, and you know what? I mean, God bless him. We should all be able to have the same health care we pay for Dick Cheney to have. But I thought it was kind of funny because here's a guy who orders other people to torture other people, and then he has a fifth heart attack. It's almost like God's torturing Dick Cheney. I call it karma board. And
karma
I told
boarding.
That joke this week about karma boarding, and I had some conservatives get really upset saying, how dare you, you know, tell jokes about Cheney's heart attack. You might have, I don't know if you heard any of this week, but in the media there's been a big right-wing backlash against comics saying, how dare you joke about this guy having a heart attack? What the hell's wrong with you, you crazy old liberal? You would hate it if we did this. And I want to point out that, you know, when people joke about Cheney, they're not joking about heart disease. No one wants to trivialize his suffering. Yes, the guy, you know, the guy may be responsible for a lot of suffering in the world, but he's someone's father, he's someone's grandfather, and when it comes to gay marriage, he's far to the left of Barack Obama. So this is no hate for Cheney. But when this is a man who has denied health care to other people, who tries to scare you with government-funded socialized health care while he receives that, when this is a guy who has instructed other people to torture in our name, and this has to him, it does merit a titter from a moral point of view.
Oh, yes.
And it's a good thing to make fun of Dick Cheney.
Well, he has it coming. And the fact that he gets his health care on us, you know, it blows my mind. It's just like when Rush Limbaugh was in Hawaii when he had his little heart episode, whatever it was. Well, the thing is, Hawaii has the most socialized health care in the nation. And there is Limbaugh talking about how great the health care was. Well, yeah, that's what we need in the rest of the country.
It was called Union Hospital where he was staying.
Oh, how ironic is that?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, we don't want to know about Rush's heart when he's a guy who was found smuggling Viagra out of Thailand.
Yeah, right. And a lot of it was the Dominican Republic, actually.
Oh, sorry, you're right. Closer to home. I confuse Rush with Gary Glitter all the time.
Oh God. All right. So John Fugelsang, we got to have our little music talk here. So I went to this event called Sunset Sessions, which is an annual event that in years past it would be in exotic locations around, you know, the world. We've been to Hawaii, we've been to the Bahamas, we've been to Puerto Vallarta and to Cancun, and now it's usually in San Diego because, you know, the economy sucks. A bunch of radio programmers are brought in, and music supervisors, the people who place music and film and TV, and a lot of bands play. There were, I think, 36 bands in 3 days that we saw, and most of them are unknowns. So we had it, Melissa Etheridge came and did a nice acoustic set for us and had a listening party, and we heard some of the songs from her new album. And Jason Mraz came because this format of radio, it's AAA, played a bunch of, really broke him. But there were other, then some bands that have been around for a little while but haven't really broken through yet, like the John Butler Trio. Do you know them?
Mm-hmm.
Awesome.
I do.
Grace Potter and the Nocturnals.
I don't know that.
Oh, my God. Awesome. I'm trying to think who else blew my mind. A band called One Eskimo, another one, Fan Farlow. I mean, the music was just so amazing this year. So that's why I didn't get to watch much of CPAC, because I was in music mode for the last week. But anyway, you would have enjoyed it.
It sounds like a great time.
It was. So I posted some pictures up at RadioOrNot.com. And, when I get time off this weekend, I'll be posting some links and more stuff up there, too. So, anyway.
Well, it was an exciting week for classic rock fans, because this week we saw the release of Johnny Cash's final Rick Rubin-produced American recording, Volume 6,
wow.
Ain't No Grave. And, when Johnny died in 2003, he left behind a lot of tapes, and Rick Rubin released a box set and then released three more albums.
I have the box set, but yeah.
Yeah, Unearthed, Essential Owning. And this one is a really beautiful record. It's almost all gospel songs,
wow.
And arranged and enhanced after his death. And this may be the last original Johnny Cash cachet music we get, so... For all the rock and roll fans I know you have out there, I want to make sure everyone knows about it, as well as Gil Scott-Heron, the legendary
The Revolution Will Not Be Televised, yeah.
Exactly. He has a new record out, and it's called I'm New Here, and that's definitely worth a listen. Paul McCartney, going back on the road, he's going to play the Hollywood Bowl for 2 dates, and has released a statement that he will be playing Beatles songs that have never been played live before.
Wow. So, you know what? When I was in L.A., I heard the commercials for the tickets going on sale on the radio, and I thought, oh, I would like to do that.
Well, it's going to be pretty fun. And I guess the biggest classic rock shout-out I can give is today would have been George Harrison's 67th birthday. And he's someone that meant a lot to me and my life and my career and my spiritual development. And his wife, Olivia, has just announced that there will be one more album of posthumous unreleased George Harrison material. It'll be coming out next year.
Wow, very cool. You know, yeah. When I was in Vegas, I think it was this summer, I got to see the Beatles' Love, which was just absolutely awesome. And there was a show on, I don't know if it was on NPR or if it was HBO or something, but it was like the making of the Beatles' Love. And it was so awesome, and there was a lot of footage of Olivia and Danny Harrison, his son, and how they put it together. But have you seen that show yet?
You know, I haven't seen the show, but I do want to recommend the soundtrack to everybody. I think I gave away like 50 copies of that soundtrack album in 2006. George Martin, the Beatles producer, got together with his son, and his son's a producer. George's hearing is gone quite a bit.
Right.
So the two of them got together, and essentially the whole album is a mashup of every Beatles song on top of every Beatles song.
It is really awesome.
Yeah, including a lot of the anthology outtakes. There's a few original strings recorded for the While My Heart Gently Weeps. The rest of it's all Beatles, mashed up with Beatles. It is the coolest thing that you can own if you don't already own it.
I agree, and you need to get out to Vegas and see it in action with all, because they've got like these holograms of the Beatles in there too. It is worth, it lives up to the hype.
When we go to Vegas, we go to see Celine Dion. I mean, that she puts on a beautiful show. What a performer that Celine Dion.
And on that note, John Fugelsang, you on with Stephanie Miller tomorrow morning?
I'll be on with her for 3 hours tomorrow. Yes, ma'am.
Very
by
cool.
By popular demand.
So we will be up and listening. John Fugelsang, find him on Twitter and Facebook, and now at johnfugelsang.com.
And love what you do. I'll talk to you soon.
There you go. Thanks a lot, John. It's good talking to you. Get some rest tonight. All right. Well, he's out of there. All right. The wonderful, wonderful John Fugelsang. All right. We've got like 2 minutes left. So should I play more sound from today, or you sound it out? You know what? MSNBC tonight. I'm so afraid that I think Keith is not there tonight, which does not bode well for his dad. His special comment last night was so moving and so heartfelt. You know, let me just talk about this for a moment, because for the last months, many months, it seems, Keith Olbermann has been off quite a bit. And, you know, for a while there were some complaints I'd see on message boards and stuff. Where's Keith? Where's Keith? And I remembered hearing sort of an offhand comment he made that his dad was sick and in the hospital. And I thought, I knew that, you know, that's what it was. And finally, one night he addressed it and he said, the reason I've been out so much is that my dad's in the hospital. And he made a plea last night. You know, he told the story of his father, and what he's been going through for the last, I think it's been like 6 months. And in recent weeks, he took a turn for the worse. And, you know, when you're hospitalized for that long and you're being poked and prodded and opened up and you get infections. I'm for Earth just wrote in the chat room, Keith has a special show of 2 hours starting in 1 hour. So if he's not there, it's his dad for sure. Well, you know what? I saw a post earlier today that Chris Matthews is going to be hosting this show tonight, the recap of the healthcare thing. So basically, Keith's father on Friday was sedated, and he's not being sedated any longer, but he hasn't woken up yet, is what Keith said last night. I cried, you know, and I noticed that when Rachel came on, she had obviously been in tears. I went through this. I lost my mother when I was 19. My mother had leukemia. All right, I'm going to run a minute or two over because I'm just starting the story. I was 19. My mom had leukemia. And actually, she didn't die of the leukemia. She had it was like a brain aneurysm is what finally killed her. So she went very quickly. She was brain dead. I mean, that's what happened. But this is after living with leukemia for many years. Years later, my father, long story, but he was pushed. My father had a nasty mouth on him and a bad temper, and he was pushed. And, he went over a waist high partition in his office, hit his head on a desk, went down and couldn't move. Long story short, he had a spinal cord injury and was a quadriplegic. He was in the hospital for almost a year in rehab after that. And I can never, he's been gone for 6 years. He was quadriplegic for 12 years. So, you know, we're going on 18 years ago already. I will never get the image out of my mind of my father, like, crying. This was my father. I'd never seen him cry before. I'd never seen him in that state. I mean, he was the rock of the family. And to see him, you know, in this helpless mode and, you know, there was nothing I could do. And there was a time when he said, I don't want to live. I don't want to live. And Keith was talking about, last night that his father at one point said he wanted it to stop. He said, help, help, help. And then he said, make it stop. And Keith said, you want me to stop everything? You want me to put a pillow over your face? And he said, yes. This is why we need to be able to talk to our family, to talk to our doctors, and have that conversation about what we do when it comes to that point. And for Sarah Palin and Chuck Grassley and all these other miserable excuses for human beings to call them death panels, and try to take the provision out of the healthcare legislation that would allow you to bill your insurance company to have this talk with your doctors is unconscionable. So Keith did mention last night that, you know, his father probably doesn't have the strength to fight off the infection and to wake up. And they're hoping that he would, you know, fight off the infection first and then wake up. But the chances are that he might be able to do neither one. It's so sad. and he called them life panels. Yes. I have a living will. You know, I'm a single mother. So I set up a trust for my daughter. And when I did it, you know, I put it all in writing, what I want to happen with her and what I want to happen with me should I ever be in a position like that. My parents are both gone now, so I don't have to make those decisions now. But this is a conversation that everybody needs to have, especially if you have elderly parents, because you get to that point where, you know, your positions change. In my case, it happened in a split second. You know, I went from being a college kid, knowing that my, you know, dad was always going to take care of me, to all of a sudden being the adult. It's a horrible position to be in. And when you haven't had that discussion ahead of time, it makes it all the more difficult. So my thoughts and, you know, I say prayers. I'm not a praying person, but my thoughts and, you know, best wishes and, you know, prayers, for lack of a better term, go out to Keith and his father tonight. I hate to leave it on this note, but that's why we're having this discussion. All right. Thank you for listening. It is Thursday night, so I will not be here tomorrow. We'll be back Monday night with another show. Everything will be up on the podcast again tonight. I thank you as always for listening and spreading the word about the show. All right. I'm Nicole Sandler, radio or not. Have a great weekend.